Potential or escaped victims. Some of Dharma's potential victims lived a different fate than he intended for them. He was also active on the homosexual dating scene, so there were several individuals who thankfully never got to see what he was truly capable of. Unnamed male jogger, 1975 or 1976. Dharma had noticed a jogger on his way home from school every day and expressed in interviews that he had overwhelming urges to knock him unconscious and just lie next to his body. On one occasion when he was 15, he took a baseball bat and waited in the bushes along the route that he always ran, intending to fulfill his fantasy, but the jogger did not come by that day. Whatever prevented him from running on the same day that Dharma had planned to attack him was probably the best thing that ever happened to him. Thankfully, he never tried to attack him again. Preston Davis, October 1979. Preston Davis was a 20-year-old African-American man when he met Dharma on a military tour in Baumholder, West Germany, with only 8 months left to serve. He said that Dharma often drank in the barracks and became obnoxious, racist, and a monster when he started drinking. Dharma used to tell soldiers, "I killed a guy in Ohio," and they would say, "You didn't kill nobody." Of course, in hindsight, they all realized that it was more than him just saying something weird. They were assigned to take part in a field exercise in Belgium in October 1979, where Davis revealed how Dharma had drugged and assaulted him during this time. Their vehicle had broken down within 3 days of completing their mission, where they had to be towed to a nearby train station. Davis blocked out the memories for decades, but after seeing Dharma's name online, all his trauma memories resurfaced, and he had to undergo intensive therapy for military sexual abuse. Davis says, "The reason he didn't kill me is because we were out in the middle of Belgium, and he had no idea how to get back to Germany." Dharma apparently said, "I should have killed that N-word when I had the chance." Davis considers himself a survivor and not a victim, saying, "The only thing I can say is karma." He can be found on Twitter as @DharmaSurvivor1. Billy Capshaw, 1979 to 1981. Capshaw was Dharma's roommate in the military from 1979 to 1981, where he endured his abuse for the 17 months that they served together. He had reported Dharma to the authorities, but they did not take the allegations seriously, calling him a pussy. He only managed to come out with his story once his father had died because he was too horrified and embarrassed for his dad to ever know. "Jeff Dharma was a sociopath, a psychopath, a narcissist," he said. Dharma beat, raped, tortured, and assaulted Capshaw for almost 2 years, often hitting him with an iron bar that he took from the structure of the bed. Dharma withheld Capshaw's mail from his family, locked him in the room — there was only one key and Dharma made sure to control it — got him AWOL'd, and made sure that he was not regularly assigned to duties. Capshaw tried to hide Dharma's money so that he could not buy more alcohol, but when he found out about it, the abuse just escalated. He attempted to escape the room out of the fire escapes and windows, but was always taken back to his barracks. "I thought about killing him. I thought about killing myself," he said. When he was sober, he was easygoing, but when he drank, he morphed into a stony-faced, menacing person, Capshaw said. He also revealed that Dharma spent hours enjoying reading children's books, which is odd. Dharma received an honorable discharge from the military on the 26th of March 1981, with superiors believing that his problems with alcohol were not applicable to civilian life. He was discharged under Chapter 9 of the Code of Military Justice, which is for drug and alcohol abuse. Bathhouse members, 1986 to 1987. Dharma started experimenting with drugging potential victims in the summer of 1986, where he frequented bathhouses such as Club Bath Milwaukee, Man's Country, and Unicorn Club. The former manager of Club Bath Milwaukee Bradley Babush, terminated Dahmer's membership in 1986 after several other members complained about him. The complaints were all the same. One minute they were having a drink with Dahmer, and the next they felt dizzy, sick, or passed out, only to wake up feeling strange and groggy. One man spent over a week in hospital recovering after paramedics collected him from the bathhouse, which was when Dahmer was banned from coming back. Another man said that his experience with Dahmer at the bathhouse was that his interest in me did not seem sexual. It seemed to be to get me to drink. Maybe he was experimenting with me to see what it would take to put somebody out. When detectives asked Dahmer if he had ever accompanied any of his drug dates home, he said that he had not, and only had one-night stands with him at the establishments, which had private rooms and areas to engage in sexual activities. Interestingly, victim Oliver Lacey had a man's country business card in his wallet, which was found in Dahmer's apartment. They may never have crossed paths there, but there is a possibility that they did. Ronald Flowers, April 3rd, 1988. On Saturday, the 3rd of April 1988, Ronald Flowers was at Club 219 in Milwaukee with some friends. At approximately 1:15 a.m., he decided to make his way home and headed out of the club to his car across the street. His car would not start, and while he was trying to get it going, a man approached him. That man was Jeff Dahmer. He said that he lived close by and that he had a car over there, which they could drive back to help get his car started. Flowers agreed, and the pair walked to Dahmer's grandmother's house where he was staying. On arrival, Dahmer directed Flowers through the back into the basement, where he pulled out a bottle of alcohol and offered him a drink. Feeling unsettled, Flowers declined and said that he would just like the help with his car if that was all right. Jeff said that was no problem, saying that he would just make himself a quick cup of coffee. He made two cups and gave one to Flowers, who obliged to drink it quickly. Once done, Flowers said, "All right, let's get going." Dahmer said, "Just a minute," while staring at him in a way that made him feel extremely unsettled. Seconds later, Flowers was dizzy and could feel himself collapsing towards the floor, remembering only seeing Dahmer's shoes before he passed out. He woke up in hospital the next day with a ligature mark on his neck and his underwear turned inside out, which traumatized him tremendously. Dahmer told police that Flowers had passed out approximately 30 minutes after drinking the drugged coffee, and that once he had, he removed his underpants and may have had oral sex with him. Flowers reported Dahmer to the Milwaukee police for drugging and assaulting him. Dahmer was questioned 2 days later, but said that they were a couple who had been dating for a while and had too much to drink on a Saturday night. The police told Flowers that it was his word against Dahmer's, even though Dahmer had a criminal record for prior indecent exposure. They shrugged it off, and Flowers was forced to simply move on with his life. The last words that he said when he left the police station was, "You're gonna catch this!" expletive, one day. He was right. During questioning, Dahmer revealed that he had decided not to kill Flowers because his grandmother had seen them together and because he was not his type. He told detectives that he had stolen $80 out of his wallet before walking him to a bus stop and giving him $1 for a bus ride to the hospital, but that he denies stealing any jewelry from him. Somsek Synthesimphone, September 25th, 1988. In September of 1988, Dahmer moved out of his grandmother's house into an apartment on 808 North 24th Street, just a few blocks away from the Oxford Apartments where he was when he was captured. In police reports, Dahmer said that he moved out in May of 1988, while other accounts state that he moved out on the same day that he lured a boy to his new home, which was September 25th, 1988. In either scenario, he was excited that he was now free to move without sneaking around his grandmother's basement and approached a young boy in the area, luring him back to his apartment, by offering him money to pose for some photographs. It was 13-year-old Somsek Sintesamphone, whose home was approximately 3 miles from Dahmer's. Address, 2634 North 56th Street, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Once at the apartment, Dahmer gave the boy a drink of coffee, Bailey's Irish Cream, and sedatives, and began to fondle and photograph him. Somehow, Somsek managed to escape Dahmer and run home, where his parents rushed him to hospital after noticing that he was drugged. Once he was fully coherent, he described the man and the apartment in detail, which resulted in a police report being filed against Dahmer. Dahmer went to court and was defended by Gerald Boyle, the same defense attorney that assisted him in his trial in 1991. Assistant District Attorney Gail Shelton said that it was a miracle that the boy escaped, and asked the judge to consider giving him a long sentence. On January 30, 1989, after pleading guilty, Dahmer was sentenced at the Circuit Court of Milwaukee County to a 1-year work release program, followed by 5 years of probation for second-degree sexual assault on a minor and enticing a minor for wrongful purposes. He also had to register as a sex offender. But before his incarceration started in June of 1989, Dahmer lured and murdered Anthony Sears on March 25, 1989, keeping his head in a carry case in his locker at work, and moving his other belongings back to his grandmother's house in West Ellis. After asking a fellow inmate to help him write a heartfelt letter to Judge Gardner, expressing his remorse for what he had done, Dahmer was released 2 months early to start his probation period in March of 1990. He temporarily moved back in with his grandmother until he finally moved into apartment 213 on May 13, 1990. Unnamed date, November 1988. After being arrested at the Ambrosia Chocolate Company for assaulting Somsek Sintesamphone and while awaiting trial, Dahmer moved out of his apartment on 808 North 24th Street in October 1988, but still had a copy of the key. He lured a potential victim back to the apartment by offering him money in exchange for nude photographs, assuming that it would still be vacant, but on arrival, he realized that a new female tenant was living there. The pair exited quickly via the stairwell, still sipping beer, and then Dahmer was hit on the back of the head and passed out. When he woke up, he remembered being in the police station filing a battery report and then being assisted to the West Ellis Memorial Hospital to get stitches. He also reported that $350 was stolen from his wallet, but was not able to identify any suspects from a lineup. E.C. Fitzpatrick. Mr. Fitzpatrick, born on the 18th of August 1965, was around 25 years old when he met Dahmer. He was driving the cab that Dahmer had taken for a ride home after a night out on the club scene. Dahmer invited him back to his apartment for a drink, to which Fitzpatrick responded that he did not drink but would smoke a joint. Dahmer said that he had marijuana at his apartment, but Fitzpatrick said that he had to work and could not take the time off. When detectives questioned him about this event, Dahmer said that he did not intend to kill him, but wanted to hang out with him and hoped that it might lead to sex. Raymond Smith, aka Cash D, robber, approximately May 20th, 1990. Approximately 1 week before murdering Raymond Smith, Dahmer had lured Cash D to his apartment by offering him money in exchange for a nude photo shoot, but had mistakenly had the drink laced with sleeping pills himself. He passed out, and when he woke up, discovered that he had been robbed of $300, his watch, and some clothing. The man was nowhere to be seen. He later told his parole officer about this incident of being robbed, conveniently leaving out the details of his true intent that evening. That night, Cash D escaped Dahmer. However, on May 27, 1991, he was again lured to his apartment and murdered by him. Perhaps he had thought that Dahmer had not remembered him, Perhaps this time he intended to make some money for a photo shoot. Either way, Dahmer successfully lured the same man home and drugged him, killed him, and ate his heart, which is a telling sign that he wanted revenge for failing the first time and subsequently being robbed. Louis Pinet, August 7, 1990. Louis Pinet, born 25th of October 1974, was 16 when he spent an evening with Dahmer. He was a cleaner at Club 219, and Dahmer recalled often seeing him sweeping glass from the floor or clearing bottles from tables. On Monday evening of August 6, 1990, they spotted each other at the Phoenix Tavern, where Dahmer said that he found him attractive and asked him to return home with him for movies, sex, and possibly a paid photo shoot. Pinet obliged, and the pair spent the evening at his apartment, kissing, masturbating, and having sex. At some point, Dahmer offered Pinet $200 to pose for nude photographs, which he agreed to come back for the following day at 12 o'clock. Dahmer assumed it meant midday the next day and waited for Pinet at the Phoenix Tavern on August 7, 1990. But after Pinet did not pitch, he thought that he had been stood up. After spending the afternoon drinking, he ended up back at the Phoenix Tavern later that night and saw Pinet there, who explained that he meant midnight all along. The pair took a cab back to Dahmer's apartment, where he asked that they stop several blocks before they got there to buy cigarettes. It was his strategy to never have anyone know exactly where he lived. Pinet confirmed that they did, in fact, buy some cigarettes on the walk to the apartment. Once there, Dahmer directed Pinet to lie on his stomach on his bed to pose for photos, which he enjoyed doing. When he was face down, Dahmer picked up a rubber mallet that he had bought earlier that same day and hit him on the back of the neck, hoping that he would pass out. He had run out of sleeping pills and did not have $30 to renew his prescription, instead opting to buy a hammer with clear intent to kill Pinet. But instead of passing out, Pinet got angry and flung himself onto his attacker. The two wrestled on the floor for a while, and Dahmer tried to convince him that he only struck him because he thought he was going to rob him and run off with the photos. Pinet, however, was not buying it and decided to leave, agreeing not to call the police. He returned to the apartment shortly after he had left, realizing that he had no money to call for a ride home and that Dahmer owed him $200. When Pinet entered the apartment for the second time, Dahmer tried to strangle him, which was not successful. Without his usual sedatives, he was powerless against his prey. This time, Pinet insisted that he was going to report him to the police and got up to leave, but sat down again when he noticed that Dahmer was holding a 6-inch knife in his hand. He asked if they could sit down and talk it through, which caught Dahmer off guard. Pinet's greatest gift at this point was time. Dahmer was sobering up and felt that he was getting to know him on a more personal level, which made him consciously decide not to kill him at that point. At approximately 7 a.m. the next morning, Dahmer walked Pinet to the bus stop on 24th in Wisconsin and even gave him money for the ride home. This potential victim did not ever report Dahmer to the police. In the first few months of 1991, they spotted each other at the Grand Avenue Mall after Dahmer had killed Ernest Miller and David Thomas and said hi as they passed each other. In March of 1991, Pinet spotted Dahmer eating ice cream at the mall and walked up to him for some small talk, which was around the time that he had killed Curtis Strawter. They parted ways and never saw each other again. To think that Pinet had seen Dahmer at the mall on two occasions between several murders, where he was just casually eating ice cream or picking up some supplies, is shocking. Unnamed one-night stand, Thanksgiving, 1990. During his incarceration in the Franklin House of Correction, Dahmer was given a day pass to spend Thanksgiving with his family, which was his father, stepmother, and grandmother. A home video was made on this occasion, where his father told him that he was looking fit and healthy, to which he responded that he was living off McDonald's and should probably eat at home more often. Little did anyone know that he was already cannibalizing some of his victims and working up a sweat as he dismembered them one by one, which is how he had managed to have the physique that he did at the time. He expressed that he felt ashamed in front of his family for what he had done, thanking them for dinner and heading out to the gay bars in downtown Milwaukee. At Club 219, he met an older white male, aged 35 to 40, who invited him home for sex. Dharma says that he was intoxicated and did not have much memory about the entire evening. He woke up the next morning hog-tied and suspended from the ceiling with hooks in a strange apartment with a man inserting a candlestick into his anus. He screamed, swore at the man, and demanded to be cut down. The man attempted to talk things through, but Dharma was in a rush because he had to be back at the House of Corrections. He grabbed his clothes and left, feeling like for once he was the one who had been sexually assaulted. If Dharma had not been legally required to be somewhere that morning, perhaps this would have been another one of his victims. He told officers that he would not be able to identify the man through photographs, as he believed that he was too intoxicated to remember him properly at the time, and had made peace with the fact that this incident was a consequence of living the promiscuous lifestyle that he did. Eric, anonymous surname, June 30th, 1991. At the Gay Pride Parade in Chicago on June 30th, 1991, Dharma approached a Hispanic male named Eric at a gay bar known as the Vortex and offered him $800 to return home with him on a Greyhound bus to spend the night and take nude photographs. When he declined Dharma's offer, he said, "I'm not leaving tonight until I find someone." Eric still refused, and Dharma moved on to find another victim. He must have thought that this was the most attractive man that he had ever seen, clearly offering him a much larger sum of money than usual, which luckily still did not convince him. Dharma managed to lure Matt Turner home that evening, victim number 14. In police interviews, he recalled that he was very drunk that night, but did remember offering a Hispanic male $800 to return home with him. Unnamed laundryman, mid-July 1991. A 20-year-old man was interviewed on July 26, 1991, who told reporters that 2 weeks prior he had been approached by Dharma a block and a half from the Oxford Apartments. He was washing clothes at a laundrette when Dharma approached him and offered him $75 to spend 3 hours with him, which would include drinking beer and rum. He saw Dharma's picture in the newspaper after his capture on July 23, 1991, shocked that this was the same man that he had encountered just 2 weeks before. Two Hispanic males, July 21, 1991. On July 21, 1991, Dharma had approached two Hispanic males at the Grand Avenue Mall, which he thought were about 18 years old, and had offered the pair $100 each to come to his house for a nude photo shoot. He told detectives that they had agreed and that after buying some beer at the liquor store together, the three of them had taken a cab to the apartment. At a traffic light on 22nd and Wisconsin, the two boys jumped out of the cab and ran away, clearly having changed their minds. Dharma told detectives that he was not planning to kill them because there were two of them, but one can only imagine that two drinks laced with sedatives would not be too difficult to prepare, and his thrill would have escalated as two victims lay side by side in his bedroom for him to enjoy. Tracy Edwards, July 22, 1991. Dharma met Edwards in front of the Eagles Club about a week before he had lured him to his apartment, where they were both sitting at a bus stop. Dharma was drinking beer, and Edwards had asked him for a cigarette. They made some small talk, and then Edwards got into the same bus as him. On July 22, 1991, Dharma was at the Grand Avenue Mall for a pizza and some beers, and spotted Edwards with two friends across the street when he exited the mall. Recognizing him, he decided to approach him and persuade him to come home with him for some beers, movies, and a photo shoot. Edwards talked to his friends about it, and once he agreed, they all walked to a liquor store with Dahmer, where he bought rum, coke, and a six-pack of beers. The friends left, and Edwards took a cab home with Dahmer, which stopped across from the Eagles Club where they initially met. Dahmer, as usual, did not want the cab driver to know where he lived, so they walked the rest of the way and entered the building through the back door, another planned action of his when he had lured a victim home. He had run out of sedatives and gave Edwards some beer and then an ordinary rum and coke. They talked about some of the gay bars in Chicago, and then Dahmer asked if Edwards would pose for bondage-themed photographs. Feeling nervous, Edwards decided to try to slow everything down and drag out the conversation, which is possibly what saved his life. While the conversation switched to discussing Dahmer's tropical fish tank, Edwards felt a cold steel handcuff being slammed onto his left wrist, after which Dahmer said that his memory got fuzzy. Edwards recalled that Dahmer had pushed a knife up against his side and had a different look on his face, which scared him. He managed to stay calm and defused Dahmer several times for the hours that followed, telling him that he was his friend and that a knife was not necessary. That they should maybe talk a little more and hang out more in the living area. He tried to escape him for 5 hours, eventually finding the perfect moment to hit him in the face and run out of the door as fast as he could. The rest is history. Edwards was greatly affected by his traumatic experience with Dahmer, becoming homeless and dependent on drugs in the years that followed. He had several run-ins with the law as time went on, eventually being sentenced to 1.5 years in prison, with 2 years of supervision in 2011, for aiding an event where another homeless man was thrown from a bridge and subsequently drowned in the Milwaukee River. He was ordered to pay the victim's mother $2,520 to cover funeral costs and to get drug and alcohol treatment. Edwards's defense attorney, Paul Kaczynski, said, "It's like Humpty Dumpty. It's like he was never able to put the pieces back together again."